Hello, listeners. This is Iris, and thank you for tuning in to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier. It's Friday, March 29th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's take a look at today's weather forecast first thing. This coming from KCRG. Storms with a slim hail threat for some on Friday evening. More rain possible toward Easter. Some active weather days are ahead as we finish out March and begin April. The warming trend we began on Thursday continues into Friday, with temperatures running another 10 or so degrees above where Thursday finished up. While we should avoid those sprinkles or flurries we saw in some areas on Thursday, we will still have a decent amount of cloud cover at times. Those clouds could still be thin enough at times to allow the sun to shine through, or breaks in the cloud cover could allow that sunlight in. Winds will also be more of a factor today, with gusts this afternoon coming from the east-southeast or southeast and reaching above 20 miles per hour. When combined with any sunshine we see, this will help push highs into the upper 50s to upper 60s from north to south. Skies do turn cloudier by this evening, with showers and storms becoming possible on a scattered basis. This development likely takes place between about 6 p.m. and 8 p.m., with the chance continuing into the first few hours of early Saturday morning. While not everyone will see a storm, those that do can expect some brief heavy downpours, lightning, and the potential for a little bit of hail. While widespread severe weather still looks unlikely, we may have just enough energy in the atmosphere to provide a storm or two that could produce hailstones up to quarter size in diameter. Other storms may contain smaller hail that ranges from pea to penny sized. If it's an option, consider parking your vehicle under cover this evening, like a garage, just in case hail occurs. Storm activity winds down by about 3 a.m. on Saturday morning, with dry conditions expected throughout Saturday. Winds will be breezy again, but from the northwest. This allows slightly cooler air to intrude into the area, with highs in the 50s to around 60 degrees. We won't be quite done with rainfall, however, with additional chances picking up by late Saturday night into early Sunday. This comes in the form of some showers and a few storms again, though, again, severe weather looks pretty unlikely during this time. Instead, it may be a bit of a damper on Easter plans for those who celebrate, so consider what changes you need to make to them if rain threatens. More rounds of rain and some storms are possible by later Sunday night into Monday, with shower activity lingering into Tuesday. Monday looks like potentially the wettest out of the handful of days with rain chances, with some areas receiving several tenths of an inch of rain just on that day. In total, most areas should get at least a quarter of an inch, with those that see repeated rounds of steadier rainfall falling into the half an inch to one inch range. Expect temperatures to remain near or just below normal for a couple of days on the tail end of this wetter period of weather conditions. Highs will only be in the 40s to 50s through Wednesday next week, with windy conditions staying likely and at least partial cloud cover. Chilly, though not as cold as the cool down we saw earlier this week. Temperatures will turn the other direction at about the same point in the week as this week, pushing highs into 50s or close to 60 on Thursday next week. Even warmer air continues to move in for Friday and the start of the following weekend, when highs well into the 60s are possible. The second half of the week does look to stay dry, though there are some indications that our active weather pattern could continue into the second week of April. Now we turn to the front page of today's Courier, and the lead article is titled Rape Contraception Coverage Undecided. Iowa Attorney General Blames Audit for Delay. No information released on audit. The story was written by Tom Barton and begins with a photograph of the Iowa State Auditor Rob Sand standing at a podium during a press conference. Dateline Des Moines. Republican Iowa Attorney General Brenna Byrd's office says an audit of the state's victim services program is delaying a decision on whether the state should continue to reimburse emergency contraception for sexual assault victims. The Iowa Attorney General's office said the audit, which has held up funding for emergency contraception for victims of sexual assault, is in its final stages, and a report would be released soon. That audit is ongoing. Until that review is complete, payment of these pending claims will be delayed, Alyssa Briolé, communications director of the office, said in a statement. Byrd paused the funding when she took office 14 months ago, while awaiting the results of the audit to decide whether to continue those payments. Federal regulations and state law require Iowa to pay expenses for sexual assault victims who seek medical help, such as the costs of forensic exams and treatment for sexually transmitted infections. Though the payments are not explicitly required by law, it has been the state's longtime practice to cover the cost of emergency contraception from the Victim Compensation Fund, which comes from fines, fees, and penalties paid by criminals. No taxpayer dollars go into the fund. In rare cases, the fund has also paid for abortions for rape victims. Byrd's office said in April of last year that it was reviewing the practice to evaluate, quote, whether this is an appropriate use of public funds, unquote. The Attorney General's office did not respond to questions from the Courier Des Moines Bureau about the scope of the audit, how it was conducted, why it's taken so long, what's delaying the release of the report, and when a decision will be made whether to continue payments. Byrd, on Tuesday, walked away from a group of reporters at the Iowa Capitol who asked to speak to her. The current status of the audit was first reported by the Des Moines Register, which filed an open records request in October. After 5 months, Byrd's office completed the records request, but denied to release the document to the Register, citing a section of Iowa public records law that excludes preliminary documents from disclosure. Victim advocates, including the Iowa Coalition Against Sexual Assault and Iowa Coalition Against Domestic Violence, have urged Byrd to continue using the program's funds to cover emergency contraception and abortion. They say cost should never be a barrier for rape victims seeking medical care, including contraception to prevent an unintended pregnancy or abortion. Byrd has not publicly said why she paused reimbursement for those services, and her office has not identified particular concerns. Iowa State Auditor Rob Sand, a Democrat, held a news conference Wednesday to condemn Byrd for using the audit to justify halting payments for care provided to victims of sexual assault and rape. He clarified that his office is not and has not been asked by the office to conduct the audit. Quote, "We are not performing any such audit. There is no third party performing any such audit. There is no audit going on here," Sand said. "There might be an internal review, but again, this is a decision made on day one in the Attorney General's office," unquote. Sand noted, other state agencies routinely conduct audits without suspending operations. Quote, "It's worth pointing out you don't stop doing something without suspecting massive fraud while you're getting an audit or review done, right?" Sand told reporters. He said, quote, "There's been no suggestion whatsoever that money from Victims Compensation Fund has been misspent during the decades under former Attorney General Tom Miller, when the state was providing reimbursements for sexual assault survivors' use of emergency contraception." Sand said Byrd's decision to pause payments, quote, "is a disservice to sexual assault survivors," unquote. He said many of those helped by the fund are juvenile victims of sexual abuse. Quote, "And the trauma and the pain that the Attorney General's decision is putting victims through in this case literally makes my skin crawl," Sand told reporters. Quote, "And this sort of word choice is simply a way to help her avoid accountability for her own decision to quit paying emergency contraception for sexual assault survivors. Maisie Stilwell, Director of Public Affairs for Planned Parenthood Advocates of Iowa, said it's, quote, absolutely deplorable that sexual assault survivors in Iowa have gone more than a year without state-covered emergency contraceptions, all because of politics. As of August of last year, the most recently reported figures from Byrd's office, more than 160 reimbursement requests for emergency contraception for sexual assault survivors were pending approval from the Iowa Attorney General's office. The backlog of requests for crime victim compensation funds at that time totaled approximately $7,500. The reimbursement requests came from hospitals and pharmacies across the state, with several dating as far back as 2020. One includes a case of child abuse. Quote, the state auditor and Planned Parenthood are flat wrong, Brolet, Byrd's press secretary, said. Quote, it's a shame that the auditor is playing politics with a critical audit of victim services and blasting misinformation to boost his own profile. We will publicly release the report once it's final, unquote. Byrd has been a vocal opponent of abortion, but sexual assault nurse examiners, along with other victim advocates, have emphasized that emergency contraceptions are not abortion pills. The medication delays or prevents ovulation, preventing a pregnancy from occurring, according to the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. Sexual assault nurse examiners who care for victims after their attack say they have continued to provide emergency contraceptions to those who request them. They also have pledged to take steps to ensure that the cost of the medications will never fall on victims. Polk and Johnson counties have set aside funding to help cover those expenses in their area, while the state program remains in question. To date, $2,319 has been spent in Johnson County, said Katie Rasmussen, coordinator for the Johnson County Sexual Assault Response Team. Initially, hospitals and pharmacies either agreed to cover the cost or held off on submitting claims while awaiting the outcome of the audit. But once a year had passed, University of Iowa hospitals and clinics decided to go forward with billing Johnson County for the costs they had been holding, Rasmussen said. Quote, we are incredibly fortunate that Johnson County agreed to give us funding to cover this cost, she said. Some hospitals are still sending bills to the Attorney General's office. Some have agreed to cover the cost for patients. And many victim advocates are exploring fundraising options to pay for it, Rasmussen said. Shannon Knudsen serves as the coordinator for sexual assault nurse examiners for Polk and Story counties. Knudsen said she is working with a pharmaceutical company to develop a statewide voucher program where the company would directly donate medications, including emergency contraception and prescriptions to treat sexually transmitted diseases, to pharmacies who dispense them to victims of sexual assault. Victim care providers said the longer the payments are halted, the less optimistic they remain that funding will ever be reinstated. Quote, the lack of communication of any timeline has made it very difficult to navigate next steps, Rasmussen said. Many of the programs and services the team provides to victims are grant-funded and have faced budget cuts the past few years. Quote, we have limited time and resources to do this work, and without clear directions on when this will end, it is difficult to determine how much effort to devote to finding other solutions, Rasmussen said. Hemp-driven drinks put under alcohol laws in bill. Under the bill, THC drinks add more liability. Story written by Tom Barton of the Courier's Des Moines Bureau. Dateline, Des Moines. Iowa bars, tap rooms, and restaurants that serve alcohol would face greater civil liability and insurance requirements if they also sell hemp-derived beverages under a proposed bill that advanced this week out of a Senate subcommittee. Senate Study Bill 3195 would expand the state's dram shop laws, which impose civil liability for selling alcohol to a visibly intoxicated or underage persons, to apply to consumable hemp products. Dram shop insurance covers liabilities associated with the sale of alcohol, specifically for overservice resulting in intoxication. The law allows people who were victims of someone's drunken behavior to file a lawsuit against bar owners and their employees if a patron is overserved and kills or injures others in crashes or other mishaps after leaving the bar. The bill would expand the applicability of Iowa's Dram Shop Act to include bars, restaurants, and other establishments licensed to serve alcohol that also serve THC drinks or edibles. Current law caps non-economic damages for pain and suffering awarded to a person injured by an intoxicated person who is overserved at $250,000, unless a jury determines there is a substantial or permanent loss or impairment of a bodily function, substantial disfigurement, or death. Economic damages, such as compensation for lost wages or medical expenses, are uncapped. The bill would increase the cap to $500,000 for those that serve consumable hemp products, such as hemp-based THC seltzer, to an intoxicated person who is overserved and hurts someone after leaving the establishment. Senator Diane Dawson, a Republican from Council Bluffs, who chaired the subcommittee, said he is concerned about how combining alcohol and THC-infused drinks can have a different effect on drinkers than those who consume just alcohol. Sometimes called cross-fading, the mixing of the two intoxicants can intensify the effects of both. Quote, "It just seems appropriate that the establishments that are selling these types of products have a higher liability than the normal alcohol establishment out here, because they are selling a product that we don't have a whole lot of information on at this point in time right now," Dawson said. "This is a different product. There's a delayed reaction there. This works differently compared to alcohol, so that the retailers have to have some liability on this if they're going to sell these," unquote. Big Grove Brewery, Iowa's top craft beer brand by sales, purchased a majority share in Climbing Kites, Iowa's first cannabis-based sparkling water. The brand, currently available at Big Grove Brewery tap rooms and other retail locations in Iowa, gives consumers a new way to get a buzz without alcohol, thanks to its federally legal THC derived from hemp. The drink was launched in 2024 by Des Moines' Lawa Brewing Team and co-founder Scott Selicks. Eric Goranson, a lobbyist representing the Iowa Restaurant Association, which was founded the same year Prohibition ended initially, to address the new dram shop liabilities, raised concerns over how establishments would provide training to detect if someone is intoxicated on THC, as well as the impact of the legislation on insurance premiums for Iowa bars, restaurants, and taverns, and the like. Quote, "We are hoping that this conversation matures and we don't have to reinvent the wheel," Goranson said. "We'd like to see what other states are doing on this as far as how does the current standard of training for employees who directly serve to visibly intoxicated person related to this when there's so many more variables involved in THC, and where it can be purchased and where and how it impacts the body. Quote, "We feel like we should be responsible for what we should be responsible for. With all the extra variables here, I feel like if we don't do this really well, we're going to be responsible for all kinds of behaviors that have nothing to do with what we're doing," unquote. Senator Bill Dotzler, a Democrat from Waterloo, who served on the subcommittee, said he had mixed emotions about the proposed bill, citing potential impact on bar business from increased insurance rates and concerns about mixing THC and alcohol. Dotzler said he's tried a hemp-based THC drink and noted his family ran a bar for 40 years. Quote, I didn't even know a thing about it until the last bill, Dotzler said, of separate legislation to limit the potency of hemp-derived cannabis products sold in Iowa. Quote, so I went, got one, and saw how it worked. And I was surprised, but I wasn't hammered, so to speak. Dotzler noted the drink had a delayed effect, which can create an opportunity to consume more before it all hits you, unquote. Hemp, legalized federally in 2018 by the passage of the Farm Bill, opened the door to commercial production of hemp-based products. Most drinks on shelves today offer THC in doses of 5 to 10 milligrams. While hemp is limited by its THC concentration, there's no limit on the number of milligrams an individual product can be made with. House File 2605, which passed out of the House and is pending in the Senate, would set a limit of 4 milligrams of THC per serving and 10 milligrams per package on consumable hemp products sold in the state. Therese Harms, a lobbyist with Consumable Hemp Advocates, urged lawmakers to clarify definitions of consumable hemp products to address intoxicating versus non-intoxicating products that include non-psychoactive CBD and low amounts of THC, the main chemical in marijuana that causes the high. Harms said most states have banned products over 10 milligrams per serving and that the World Health Organization, National Institutes of Health, and other organizations, quote, recognize that there is some therapeutic value in low-potency CBD products, unquote. Quote, if you can provide definitions for these, then it can get to the issue of what you're trying to control, which is these high-potency drinks that are only THC, Harms said. Leslie Carpenter, with Iowa Mental Health Advocacy, said the group supports the bill. Quote, I feel that there needs to be a responsibility of anyone selling these products and making money on them, because too many people have no idea of the risks, she said. She said in other states where high-potency THC drinks are legal, there have been increased incidents of impaired driving and car crashes, and, quote, people going into psychosis, people developing schizophrenia, even when they don't have a family history of mental illness in their family, unquote. Dawson said he intends to amend the bill, but was still having conversations as to what that would entail. The bill is now eligible for consideration by the full Senate Ways and Means Committee. Cedar Bend Humane Society, desperate for food donations to feed shelter dogs and cats. The story was written by Melody Parker. Dateline, Waterloo. Hungry dogs and cats at Cedar Bend Humane Society need to eat, but the cupboard is nearly bare. In the last 6 months, the shelter has struggled to feed the 300-plus animals in its care. Now the situation is becoming desperate. For the first time in 5 years, Cedar Bend is sponsoring a Spring into Action pet food drive, now through April 5th. Quote, we've seen a decline in the last 1.5 years of regular food donations, and it's gotten worse in recent months, said Christy Gardner, CBHS Executive Director. And at this point in the article, we have a photograph showing kennel attendant Mia Wheeler, and she has walked down an aisle with dog and other pet cages on either side of her, and she's scooping dry pet food out of a 55-gallon plastic drum. And there's a little dog named Sue off to her right side, looking through clear plexiglass, waiting and anticipating some food. Quote, as a nonprofit organization, we're donation-based. The shelter runs on donations we receive and community support. I don't know if it's the economy having an impact, but we haven't received the food donations we usually receive, unquote. In previous years, the shelter has had abundant food donations, enough to provide food to shelters in neighboring communities. CBHS also operates the PAWS Pantry, which distributes pet food through the Northeast Iowa Food Bank for low-income pet owners. Now, Paw's Pantry is closed until at least May 1st. Quote, "It's sad for me, because there's such a big need in our community," Gardner said. "If we can help people by providing food to feed their pet, it may help prevent some of the animals coming to the shelter." The shelter has bulged at the seams with stray, surrendered, abandoned, and injured pets in recent months. Last year, 3,566 animals were brought to the shelter. In addition, there are puppies and kittens to feed, as well as animals being held for court cases and some animals that require special diets. Housed in three buildings, the homeless pets are fed twice daily, in the morning and the evening. Quote, "We feed about 50 pounds of dog food and 50 pounds of cat food a day in each of the three buildings. So, 150 pounds a day for dogs and cats is average," she explained. While CBHS has been forced to purchase food to help fill the tummies of their furry residents, quote, "That takes away funds from other areas, such as medical spays and neuters and other needs. We especially need cat food." The public is being asked to donate new, unopened bags of dry pet food for dogs and cats. Dry food with no dye is preferred, and donors are asked to check expiration dates. Quote, "We prefer unopened bags, but if someone has an open bag of food their pet didn't like, we'll take it," Gardner said. Drop-off locations are available in the CBHS Adoption Center from noon to 6 p.m. at 1166 West Airline Highway, Waterloo. The shelter also is working with local retailers, grocery stores, pet stores, and big box stores to figure out ways to provide food for the animals. Quote, "We're making a push now, but we'll be accepting donations beyond April 5th. If someone doesn't want to go out and buy dry food to drop off, they can send Cedar Bend a donation earmarked for food," Gardner said. For more information on Cedar Bend, adoptable pets and services, visit www.cedarbendhumane.org. Sexual assault survivor Chanel Miller to speak at Luncheon of Light in Cedar Falls. Story written by Melody Parker. Dateline Cedar Falls. Nationally known author, artist, and sexual assault survivor Chanel Miller will be keynote speaker at the Riverview Center's 5th Annual Luncheon of Light on April 19th at the Bienvenue Event Center. The event is from 11 a.m. to 1:30 p.m. Tickets are $50 per person, available at riverviewcenter.org/events. Space is limited. There will also be an auction of items donated by local businesses, and Riverview staff will share stories about the impact of center services. On June 2, 2016, Stanford University athlete Brock Turner was found guilty of sexually assaulting an unconscious woman outside of a fraternity house. When Miller, known as Emily Doe, read her victim impact statement, the 7,000-word description of the assault's effect on her life went viral. Quote, "My damage was internal, unseen. I carry it with me. You took away my worth, my privacy, my energy, my time, my safety, my intimacy, my confidence, my own voice until today," she said that day in court. Turner was found guilty of 3 felony counts of sexual assault with a maximum sentence of 14 years. But Judge Aaron Persky sentenced Turner to 6 months in jail. He served 3 months. Miller went public with her real name in 2019 and wrote a memoir, Know My Name. Quote, "National events come to feel local in our work. I've read her book and her victim statement, and I'm impressed by the amazing grace and resilience she has shown. I'm impressed that she has used her experience as a platform to move forward and inform others," said Gwen Bramlett Hecker, Riverview Center Executive Director. Riverview Center provides sexual assault services. And now, listeners, we just take a moment of your time to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, March 29th, on IRIS, That's IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and the Print Handicapped. Now, let's listen to this message.
The possibility of lung cancer can be pretty scary, especially if you're one of approximately 8 million current or former smokers at high risk. That's why SaveByTheScan.org wants you to know that now there's a breakthrough low-dose CT scan that can detect lung cancer early, and it only takes 60 seconds. You stop smoking, now start screening. For an easy quiz to see if you're eligible, visit SaveByTheScan.org. It could save your life. SaveByTheScan.org is brought to you by the American Lung Association's Lung Force Initiative and the Ad Council.
Now, let's turn to the opinion section. For our first editorial today, we turn to Randy Evans, who writes a column called Stray Thoughts. These government officials did what? What are they thinking? That is a question I ask myself a lot lately. Those were the first words out of my mouth when the Manhattan District Attorney had to postpone Donald Trump's New York criminal trial on the alleged hush money payments to porn star Stormy Daniels, the delay necessitated because government lawyers had dropped the ball. I muttered those words during several days of court hearings in Georgia into Atlanta prosecutor Fannie Willis' affair with a subordinate prosecutor, the one she chose to lead the criminal case against Trump and a dozen other defendants for trying to undo that state's 2020 presidential election results. And those words come to mind about bills the Iowa legislature is considering that would affect criminal cases like those brought against the state university athletes for their online wagers on sporting events. What were these government officials thinking? That is an excellent question in these cases. In New York City, Trump's trial in state court was scheduled to start March 25th, but the date went out the window when Manhattan District Attorney Alvin Bragg announced the federal government, after a year's delay, finally handed over 100,000 pages of potential evidence to Trump's defense lawyers. What were the federal attorneys thinking? They know the rules of discovery, the obligation of prosecutors to turn over potentially exculpatory materials to a criminal defendant. They knew the nation is watching the New York case against Trump like hawks. And they surely knew any attempt to cut corners would give America's court system an embarrassing black eye, especially when Trump and many supporters believe the courts and government lawyers have it in for him. The nation has been watching the Georgia election case like hawks, too. The former president faces 13 state charges relating to his efforts to undo Joe Biden's whisker-thin victory in that state in 2020. Atlanta prosecutor Fannie Willis should have been savvy enough to know her every move would be scrutinized by critics. So what was she thinking when she decided to engage in an affair with a man she picked to handle the Trump case? Well-educated people in positions of authority should be smart enough to know they need to be above even the appearance of a conflict when their every move will be dissected. That brings me to Iowa. Criminal charges of illegal gambling were first filed last summer against 25 athletes and student managers at Iowa State University and the University of Iowa. The cases have had a devastating effect on those athletes' careers and held them up to ridicule. They lost their ability to compete. Most agreed to plead guilty to less serious charges to avoid the possibility of bigger fines by going to trial. But attorneys for four ISU athletes or former athletes fought back. They took sworn statements, called depositions from investigators, and used subpoenas to obtain evidence agents gathered. What the lawyers learned suggests the actions of the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation agents were an unconstitutional invasion of students' privacy rights. Story County prosecutors agreed to drop the charges against the four athletes when the defense attorney's findings became public. The DCI's tactics in this investigation are an embarrassing black mark on this respected law enforcement agency, just as delays by federal officials in the New York criminal case and the astoundingly poor judgment by the Georgia prosecutor are embarrassing black marks on our judicial system, too. The response by state officials in Iowa is telling, however. Rather than evaluating how the lapse of judgment occurred and establishing clear procedures to ensure people are not subjected to unreasonable invasion of their privacy, state officials seem more interested in providing a legal shield to block defense lawyers from uncovering such scandals in the future. The DCI's disturbing conduct came to light because the athletes' attorneys were able to issue investigative subpoenas and compel the deposition testimony of DCI agents to learn state agents gathered digital evidence of student gambling without first providing sufficient legal justification for a judge to issue a search warrant. Bills now before the legislature, pushed by Attorney General Brenna Byrd, the DCI, and a state senator who is a DCI agent, would virtually eliminate the use of investigative subpoenas and the ability of criminal defendants to take sworn testimony from witnesses and investigators. Andrew Mertens, the executive director of the Iowa Association for Justice, an organization of trial lawyers, has a chilling analysis of these proposals. By way of disclosure, Mertens is on the board of trustees of the Iowa Freedom of Information Association, the organization I lead. Quote, "These subpoenas are vital tools, especially when the state attempts to cover up evidence of their own misdeeds, as they've done in the gambling cases," Mertens wrote in a statement. Quote, "Had the Attorney General's pending bill been law, these cases would have likely never been dismissed, ruining the students' athletic careers, and the vast invasion of student privacy at our state universities would have never been uncovered. The Attorney General's pending bill could have let the DCI get away with their unconstitutional, warrantless invasion without consequence," unquote. Mertens said defense attorneys face stringent requirements under existing Iowa court rules before they can issue subpoenas. The Attorney General's bill seeks to practically eliminate this already limited investigatory tool in criminal cases. In civil cases, on the other hand, where money is on the line rather than a person's freedoms, attorneys defending insurance companies or the state have much broader ability to subpoena evidence under existing court rules, he pointed out. Mertens added, quote, "It all begs the question, are these legislative proposals motivated by the state's desire to hide their conduct during this and similar investigations? Should these be held to account or allowed to run roughshod over Iowans' constitutional rights?" Unquote. That is a good question. And so is this one. What were they thinking? Next, from the Des Moines Register, writer Rick Phillips, Caitlin Clark and the Iowa Hawkeyes gave us something we all needed. Almost everything that can be said about Caitlin Clark has been said. A transcendent player, a generational player, gracious and generous, someone who has elevated not just women's basketball, but the game of basketball to a higher public awareness. It's all true, but I think there is so much more about this player and her team that explains the massive public reaction to their success. We all needed Caitlin Clark and the Iowa Hawkeyes. The pandemic and the social unrest has changed all of us. We have worked ourselves into a society with a paper-thin veneer, at risk of offending someone of something every time we open our mouths. It's not like Caitlin Clark is a new arrival on the scene. She was a great player in high school and has obviously been on a meteoric rise to world-class fame ever since. Nor is it something new about Lisa Bluter. She built a great program at Drake and has just continued to do great things at Iowa. No, what happened is a perfect convergence of time and events. Caitlin Clark and the Iowa Hawkeye women arrived on the scene at just the right time. From their eye-popping run through the NCAA tournament last year and all the records that have fallen this year, The Hawks have given us a big dose of a few things we all need: grit and determination, confidence and hope, class and grace, teamwork and commitment, and, most importantly, joy. I have heard nothing political or racial in any of the conversations about this amazing young woman. What a relief and what a legacy. Thank you, Caitlin. And now from the New York Times, writer Paul Krugman, why has Obamacare worked? And the opinion piece begins with a photograph of the United States Capitol building with the American flag flying, and superimposed over the dome is a huge doctor's stethoscope. We've just passed the 14th anniversary of the enactment of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. the Affordable Care Act, a.k.a. Obamacare, although many of the law's provisions didn't take effect until 2014. In its early years, Obamacare was the subject of fierce criticism from both the left and the right. Actually, as I pointed out in my most recent column, politicians on the right are still saying the same things they said a decade ago, pretending that their predictions of doom haven't been falsified by events. But Obamacare has survived, greatly expanding health insurance coverage without busting the budget. Critics on the left complain that it hasn't produced truly universal health care, which indeed it hasn't, but it has done a lot and has become quite popular. So why has Obamacare worked as well as it has? The thing is, critics of Obamacare from the left have a point. If your goal is to give people access to health care, why not just give them access by instituting a single-payer system in which the government pays the bills? This was, in fact, what we did for seniors when Medicare was created in the 1960s. The ACA, however, created a complicated system in which people have to buy their own insurance, although in many cases the government picks up much of the tab. And the complexity of the system, combined with the fact that important parts of it are run by state governments, some of which are controlled by conservatives who want Obamacare to fail, means that a lot of people fall through the cracks. 8% of U.S. population is still uninsured, although that's a lot better than pre-ACA situation. Why, then, didn't we go for a single payer? Politics. It wasn't just a matter of buying off the insurance industry by keeping it at the center of American health care, although that was part of it. More important, I believe, was the perceived need to avoid disturbing Americans happy with their existing health coverage, mostly those getting insurance via their employers. Rather than reforming our whole health insurance system, Obamacare sought to fill the holes in our system by adding stuff. In particular, it tried to create a working marketplace in which individuals not covered by their employers could find affordable health insurance. Many people, especially but not only on the right, expected this effort to fail. I don't want to get too deep into the weeds here, but the ACA prohibited insurers from denying coverage or charging higher premiums to people with pre-existing medical conditions. This kind of regulation can cause a death spiral. Too few healthy people buy insurance, so the risk pool gets worse, which drives up premiums, which drives out still more relatively healthy people, and so on. Initially, the ACA included a mandate, a penalty on Americans who didn't have insurance, but it's not clear how effective the insurance mandate ever was, and Republicans eliminated the penalty in 2017. Yet, Obamacare didn't collapse. Why not? Here's how I'd put it. In practice, Obamacare has ended up functioning a lot like a single-payer system, after all, and such systems aren't subject to death spirals. First, a large part of the rise in health coverage came from an expansion of Medicaid, the government health insurance for lower-income Americans, single-payer, although less generous than Medicare. Second, individual purchase of insurance on the ACA-created marketplaces is subsidized. In fact, last year, 91% of Marketplace enrollees were receiving so-called premium tax credits. In many cases, these credits cover a large part of individuals' premiums. Also, crucially, the subsidies don't take the form of lump sum credits. Instead, the law specifies a maximum percentage of income that enrollees can pay for insurance. That percentage depends on your income and makes up the difference if premiums exceed that maximum. This isn't single payer exactly, but it does mean that the government is the marginal payer, in the sense that even if premiums rise, most people don't pay more. The government picks up the extra bills. This, in turn, means that a death spiral basically can't happen, because even if healthy people drop their insurance, costs for most enrollees don't rise. This is smart policy design. Among other things, it protects the ACA from hostile politicians. Soon after taking office in 2017, Donald Trump declared that, quote, "the best thing politically is to let Obamacare explode," unquote. And while his attempt to repeal the law failed, his administration engaged in acts of sabotage, in effect, trying to induce a death spiral. But the subsidies frustrated this plan. In 2019, I asked Nancy Pelosi about how politicians like her had interacted with the clever policy wonks who devised such a robust system. Quote, "I am a wonk," she replied. Obamacare, then, has defied the doomsayers. But what about warnings that it would prove unsustainably costly? As I noted in the column, federal spending on health care is currently considerably lower than the Congressional Budget Office projected before the ACA went into effect, despite the expansion of coverage. How is this possible? Part of the answer is that before Obamacare went into effect, the uninsured in America consisted disproportionately of relatively young adults, and the health costs of younger people are, on average, much lower than those of seniors, who were already covered by Medicare. So covering many of the uninsured was never going to cost all that much, unless the policy design was fatally flawed, which it wasn't. Beyond that, the enactment of the ACA coincided with a sustained slowdown in the growth of overall health care spending. We don't know exactly why this happened. The ACA contained a number of measures intended to control costs, which may partly explain the bending of the curve. It's worth noting, however, that health care costs have leveled off across the advanced world. It's possible that the direction of technological progress in medicine has shifted, generating fewer ways to treat the previously untreatable and more ways to deliver care more cheaply. And to some extent, we may be seeing the effects of Stein's law. If something cannot go on forever, it will stop. Health spending couldn't absorb an ever-growing share of national income, so at a certain point, insurers and providers began to take cost control seriously. In any case, Obamacare has worked. It didn't provide universal coverage, but it did provide health insurance to millions of Americans, some of whom desperately needed that safety net, and it did so without breaking the bank. Predictions that the ACA would be unworkable have been proved wrong. At this point, the only serious threat the program faces, and it is a serious threat, is political. People who kept insisting, wrongly, that health care reform would die of its own accord may simply step in to kill it. Local professors and students uncover plenty of uses for AI. The story was written by Andy Malone. Being nice to technology has taken on a whole new meaning in the ChatGPT era. Before the November 2022 introduction of the chatbot, sparking the artificial intelligence craze, quote, "technology nice may have meant putting a case around a smartphone or not overloading a laptop with too many files. But Hawkeye Community College professors, among many in higher education embracing AI, have found that literally being polite while communicating with ChatGPT has its benefits. Say, "Hi, Chat," says Corrine Hulke Farnham, a communications director. Don't just give it orders, and you'll get better results, says Seth Vickers, an instructional designer helping professors use AI and create relevant guidelines in the classroom. The new tools have a myriad of uses, but also have foibles, just like humans. Matthew Wilson, marketing director at the University of Northern Iowa, often reminds his students. His industry has known for years. Its professionals have been utilizing AI a long time, and ChatGPT is just another tool. Users must be careful. Quote, sometimes it makes stuff up, Wilson said. In developing marketing content, he learned the dangers when Google's original position on AI-generated material was that it was spam, sometimes ranking it lower in search results or not at all. That's not the case now. Google has developed its own AI products. But that hasn't made a dent in the list of red flags. AI doesn't always tell the truth, and it also can be a master thief. Users have to be careful with how closely its outputs mimic intellectual property. Another worry is when it decides to act less like a human and more like a robot. Quote, AI's content is all based on word predictability. So oftentimes the content it generates may be well-structured and it sounds good, but it's not very interesting, or it's very generic, or doesn't have any character behind it, said Wilson. So another thing we talk about is how do we inject some personality, personal brand, and voice into that copy, unquote. At Hawkeye, AI tools have helped clone humans, in a sense. Psychology instructor Lee Parker uses AI to help create case studies of different personas with mental illnesses for students to identify and diagnose as practice for the real world. Quote, I start students off with a persona and a dossier of information and these different parts of this character. And AI helps me because I can create a warning letter from a fictitious employer that's warning this fictitious person about their behavior. There's love letters and to-do lists, for instance, it can create as warnings, and also now it can mimic voices, unquote. ChatGPT isn't the only AI platform professors are using. They use AI tools like EduAid, Gemini, formerly Bard, and Microsoft Copilot to develop discussion boards and learning objectives, along with syllabuses and annotated bibliographies. Such mundane examples of uses for AI may not excite outsiders, but do make life easier. Parker used AI to clarify assignment guides, project overviews, and come up with revisions that make them clearer to students, sidestepping avoidable questions. Jim O'Loughlin, English professor and head of the Languages and Literatures Department at UNI, discovered a way to create a release granting permission for high school writers to have their work published. Quote, I was hunting around thinking maybe I could find something, but I couldn't find something and thought this is a job for ChatGPT, he said. 15 seconds later, I had a workable draft that I could then fix up. That was a time saver for me, unquote. Students hand off tasks to the technology as well. Evie Flint, a second semester Hawkeye student from England, uses AI to navigate American life and save herself time better spent practicing with the college's soccer team. She's found herself baffled by words and phrases used in lectures with, quote, the American sense. Rather than just sit there confused, she uses AI to clarify. O'Loughlin thinks writing will be one of the industries most impacted by AI, but it won't replace the scribe, he said. And that's proven in the case of Flint. Flint knows the ideas she wants to put on paper. With the help of ChatGPT and what's available through Microsoft Edge, she can tie them together. Quote, what is the best way to order these? And then it tells you how to do an introduction, put them in an order, and then tells you how to do a conclusion, Flint said. Higher education is benefiting. At UNI, there are also computer science students and professors completing advanced research. Machine learning is the focus for seniors Marina Avdamina and Almady Kazakhstan and Blake Schlechter of Dubuque. They are working with Professor Dayarda Jazignani to create an app called iBrush. It's a watch connected to an app capable of converting movement into data. The lines and lines of figures mixed with machine learning models can show how often one brushes their teeth and whether they're doing a good job. Quote, "It's called machine learning, but really you're just giving the machine a preset of data to work off of so that it later can make its decisions based off that new data." Quote, "In the testing phases, you have to go back and check if the result is right to signal if the machine learning model is working. If it's not, then you'd have to adjust those parameters." Free UNI lecture to focus on Jerusalem in the time of Jesus. Story written by Courier staff. The story opens with a color photograph of Temple Mount in Jerusalem. Dateline, Cedar Falls. The public can learn about geographic sites associated with Jesus at a free lecture, quote, "Jerusalem in the Time of Jesus," at 6:30 p.m. on April 8th. The event will be in the John Deere Auditorium of the Curris Business Building on the University of Northern Iowa campus. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Friday, March 29th. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can listen to a recording of this reading of the Courier or of the other newspapers around Iowa that we read. Just visit our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.